I wondered how they viewed killing for food, if they did kill, or even consuming fruit and vegetables, since these two were living in their own form of expression. And as always, the answer came without my speaking. There is nothing illogical in this, my son. When you eat a lettuce leaf, it becomes a part of you, does it not? As a result, from then on it begins to experience things with you. So what you have actually done is to transmute one form into your own form. Had this not been the case, the lettuce leaf would have matured, then gone to seed in order to replenish its own kind again, and that would have been its total experience. But by serving you, it has been elevated to a higher service through you. Motive also enters into this principle. If your motive is to destroy or injure or exploit, then it is wrong. But if your motive embraces the service you can render another form by bringing it up to your standard, through you, then it is right. For you are really transmuting a mineral from one state to another that it may be of still greater service. In doing this, you are acting according to the law of growth or development, of times called devolution in your world. This is the law of your creator. The people of your world make much of form, disintegration, not realizing the law of elevation, because they have begun to think that the form is all there is. But the form is only a channel through which life, or intelligence, expresses. All-inclusive intelligence cannot express through a lettuce leaf. So the lettuce leaf must be transmuted by gradual stages into a higher form through which to express greater service. That is the way it is rewarded. When this law is fully accepted and lived by your Earthmen as it has been accepted and lived by inhabitants of other planets and systems, the atmospheric conditions of Earth will be sweetened. For every form will then give off joyous radiations from itself that will permeate the air within which mankind lives. You have wanted to know by what method we have evolved to the state in which we are now living. These are the fundamental laws by which we live, and by which Earthmen can also evolve, if they choose to accept and live them. When men of Earth have learned that they are not the body or the house, but merely the occupant of the body or the house, they can build homes anywhere they will, for they too will become masters of elements instead of being mastered by them. While you of Earth have come into a knowledge of governing certain elements to certain points, misuse of your knowledge is widespread, and the elements are turning to destroy you, as many other civilizations on your Earth have been destroyed in the past. This is the stage in which we find Earthmen today. We can but continue trying to help wherever opportunity presents itself, but it is difficult to reach in sufficient numbers minds so little developed as those of earthly men. The master was silent for a moment. Then he said, "This is not the first time you have been brought into our ships, nor will it be the last. You may rest assured that we of other worlds from time to time will bring you truth that you may pass it on to your fellow men of Earth. We will tell you of the physical life of other worlds, as well as what you call spiritual or religious truths, although we do not make that kind of division. There is but one life. That life is all-inclusive, and until men of Earth realize that they cannot serve or live two lives, but only one, they will be constantly opposing one another. That is one major truth that must be learned by all Earthmen before life on your world can match life on other planets. And now, my son, it is time for your return to Earth. What you have learned can be of great value to the people of your planet. Speak to them by word of mouth and by written word. Do not fear lest you forget any of what you have been told. For as you speak or write, with the first thought a continuous flow of memory will come to you. In this beautiful ship of another world there was peace. The lesson of the night had been deep in understanding and meaning. Somehow, I knew that all had heard this same lesson, perhaps many times throughout their lives. But it seemed to be one that they loved, as if in the telling a new something opened within each listener and he grew larger in his own understanding. Again I wished I need not return to Earth, but that I might remain with these gracious friends and journey with them to other worlds. But the wise one said, "Son, there is much yet to be done on your Earth. The people are hungry and must be fed. You will return and share with them this food of the Spirit that they may not perish in the darkness of ignorance that has prevailed upon your Earth throughout so many generations. On the journey back I seemed still to hear the master's words falling with gentle insistence against my consciousness in the silence that remained unbroken by either Amzal or myself. It was the same during the drive back to the city. I vaguely remembered taking leave of the pilot of the scout, but I do not think any words were exchanged. When Ram stopped at the entrance of the hotel, I slowly stepped out onto the sidewalk. Then I turned, dimly aware of something I wanted to say. Although Ram probably knew what it was before I myself, he waited quietly, understanding in his eyes and the grave smile on his lips. Then, suddenly, it came to me. The mental message I received this time, I said, it seemed so much clearer. I seemed to know more certainly when I left for Los Angeles what was going to happen. Did the master himself contact me mentally this time? Yes, Ram said, he did. And that is largely responsible for the difference, although your own ability to receive is growing. But the exaltation of spirit I felt, I went on, stumbling in an effort to express it. I am sure that must have come to me through the master. Yes, Ram said again, he is one of the most evolved beings still functioning within our system. Just to be in his presence is to grow in love and understanding. We are all fortunate. We said our farewells and I went into the hotel. As always after such meetings, I had no desire to sleep. This time I did not even look to see what time it was. I know that I stood a long while at the window, looking up, not down. I had the strange feeling of separation within myself that I had experienced before, only this time there was no sadness in it. I believe I may have spoken my thoughts aloud. It is one. It is all one. There and here and everywhere. There is no separation. The banquet and a farewell. The next contact occurred on August 23, 1954. Desmond Leslie was in Los Angeles at the time for the purpose of fulfilling a lecture engagement. He knew that I was about to have this contact and was most anxious to be taken with me. While I'd hoped for this, the brothers, for reasons which they did not give, were not able to grant the request. As I look back, I think it was because the nature of some of the things which were shown and explained to me this time were not designed for one without previous contacts. My friends Firkin and Ram met me as usual. En route to the scout, Firkin said, I must tell you that tonight's meeting will be a farewell for you and for us. After we bring you back to your hotel tonight, we return to the scout, and then on out to the carrier which will take us back to our home planets. Our mission on Earth is fulfilled. A great sadness surged up in me. Ram said quickly, but you are losing us only in bodily form. Don't forget that we can still communicate mentally, wherever we are. I took what comfort I could from this thought, but at the moment it seemed little enough. Then Firkin said, his voice full of comprehension, you are our friend, and all the space that may stretch between us can never change that. I felt ashamed of my emotion. Although I could not entirely banish it, I did manage to rise above it to some extent. I found myself wondering if some other contact man, or men, living temporarily on our Earth, might possibly be assigned to meeting me in future. But to this unspoken question, neither vouchsafed an answer. I was left with the feeling that this might indeed be farewell, at least for some time to come, not only to the two friends between whom I now sat as we rode along, but to any further excursions into space. This emotion, as I think can be imagined, lent to all the new and wonderful things I was to see this night a poignancy which quickened my deep appreciation. This, added to the gratitude for what had already been granted, produced a fullness in my heart that I could never put into words. Inasmuch as I have already described in detail a journey in this same scout, I shall state only that I found Orthon awaiting us with the little ship hovering slightly above the ground, ready for an immediate takeoff. On this trip we did not even sit down. I divided my attention between watching the changing graphs and Orthon at the control panels. As we entered the Venusian carrier, this time I was entirely free of any dropping sensation in the pit of my stomach. We reached the platform and stopped again, as on our first trip. The same man was there to attach the clamp over the scout for its recharge, but this time he followed us down the steps and into the lounge. Immediately on entering, I was struck by a general air of festivity. There were a great many people present whom I had never seen before. I was delighted when I saw Ilmeth and Galna coming forward to greet me warmly. Did anyone tell you about the surprise we have for you tonight? Galna asked, and without waiting for a reply continued enthusiastically, a certain promise made to you will be fulfilled. While Galna was speaking, Ilmeth had given me a goblet of the delicious fruit juice. I noticed that both girls were dressed in pilot uniforms and I felt sure this meant a trip into space. There were many men present and 8 women, including Galna and Ilmeth. The other women were dressed in the same kind of lovely gowns the latter two had worn when first I met them. The men were in comfortable shirts and trousers. Again everyone wore sandals. Although no introductions were made, I did not miss them, for all greeted me as friends, and a few even called me by name. When the salutations were over, I became aware of soft music in the background, a little reminiscent of what we call Oriental. Although Rama had been given a goblet of the juice, I noticed that my other friends did not join us. This was explained when Ilmeth said, "We must go to our posts now to carry out the surprise Galna mentioned. This time, Rama will stay with you." As Orthon and Galna left in one direction, Firkan and Ilmeth started toward the opposite end of the ship. Rama and I sipped our drinks in silence for a few moments. I was happy to be a part of the warmth and joyousness that pervaded this room. It helped to keep in the background the feeling of sadness over the parting that would take place tonight. Several groups were playing games that were strange to me and Ram, noticing my interest, suggested that we stroll around for a closer view. 4 of the men were seated at a small table playing a game with cards. These were quite different from ours, though much the same size. There were no numbers on them, but all had markings representing something. I looked to see if any 2 were alike. But, so far as I could see, none were. Another group of men were rolling little colored balls along a smooth board. I guessed that these must have been charged with some kind of magnetism, since there were no grooves in the board and yet the balls did not move freely. Certain ones seemed to do the attracting, drawing the others toward them. Another game somewhat resembled our table tennis, except that 2 balls were kept in place simultaneously, for which great skill was obviously required. The women seemed very good at this. I was struck by the absence of loud talking, laughing or other distractions. Everyone was obviously enjoying himself, and able to do so without becoming raucous over it as so often happens on Earth. Nor did anyone seem to take the game seriously, as so many of us do. The atmosphere was one of gaiety and relaxation. Often the players glanced up at us with friendly smiles. Some spoke to us and I found myself still amazed to hear these people speaking so fluently in my tongue. After a while, Rama suggested, "Shall we go to the control room? There are some things to show you in there which I am certain you will find interesting." With our drinks still in hand, I gladly followed him into the large room with the many charts, graphs and instruments which I had seen on my first visit to this ship. As we entered, Rama must have touched a button for I saw 2 very small seats rise as if by magic out of the floor. And at the same time, directly in front of them, I saw our moon appear in the center of a large screen. I was amazed at how close it looked, and not at all as if pictured on a screen, but with depth of space all around it. So this was the surprise. For a moment I thought we might be actually coming in for a landing. Rama said, "You are now looking at the familiar side of your moon, but we are not landing on it. The image is being reflected on the screen from one of the telescopes which was not in operation the first time you were with us. Look closely as we approach the surface and you will note considerable activity. In the numerous large craters which you see from Earth you will notice very large hangars, which you do not see. Notice, too, that the terrain here is very similar to your deserts. We have built these hangars on such a scale in order that much larger ships than this one can enter easily. Also within these hangars are living quarters for a number of workers and their families, provided with every comfort. Water in abundance is piped in from the mountains, just as you have done on your Earth for the purpose of bringing fertility to your desert areas. When a ship enters these hangars, a process of depressurizing the passengers takes place. This requires about 24 hours. Were this not done, The people would experience the greatest discomfort in stepping out on the moon. Such a depressurization process is not yet conceivable to Earthlings. They understand too little about the bodily functions and their control. Actually, human lungs are able to adjust themselves to very low as well as high pressure, if deflation or inflation is not done too quickly. If hurried, death would result. I would gladly have undergone the necessary deflation for the privilege of actually landing on the moon. There was nothing demanding my immediate return to Earth. But with a sympathetic smile, Ram said, "We have many things in store for you besides showing you the other side of your satellite before we return you to Earth. Watch closely now, for we are approaching the moon's rim. Notice those clouds forming. They are light and appear to be coming from nowhere, as clouds often do. Most of them gain no density whatsoever but dissipate almost immediately. Yet, under favorable conditions, some occasionally do gain density. It is the shadows of these which have been seen through telescopes from Earth. Now we are approaching the side never seen from Earth. Look at the surface directly below us. See, there are mountains in this section. You can even see snow on the peaks of the higher ones, and a growth of heavy timber on the lower slopes. On this side of the moon are a number of mountain lakes and rivers. You can see one of the lakes below. The rivers empty into a very large body of water. Now you can see a number of communities of varying sizes, both in the valleys and on the mountain slopes. Preferences of people here, as anywhere else, vary in regard to living at one or another altitude. And here, as elsewhere, the natural activities to support life are very similar to those wherever mankind is found. Had we time to land and be depressurized, Ramu went on, and then travel about, you would personally meet some of the people. But as far as studying the surface of the moon is concerned, the way you are viewing it now is far more practical. I realize the truth of this as a fair-sized city assembled on the screen in front of us. Actually, we seem to be drifting over the rooftops, and I could see people walking along clean, narrow streets. There was a more thickly built-up central section which I assumed to be the business district, although it was not crowded with people. I noticed no cars of any kind parked along the streets, although I did see several vehicles moving just above the streets, since they appeared to have no wheels. In size they were comparable to our buses, varying from one another in about the same degree. Ramu explained, a few of the people here do have their own conveyances, but for the most part they depend on the public utilities at which you are looking. Just outside the city proper was a comparatively large cleared section with an immense building along one side. It looked like a hangar, and Ramu confirmed this by saying, "We have to construct a few hangars near the cities for convenience in landing with the supplies we bring to the population here, everything not available locally for their needs. In exchange, they furnish us with certain minerals found on the moon." As I watched, the city seemed suddenly to retreat, and Ramu told me that we were now traveling back into space between the moon and the Earth. "Have you any questions before we return to the lounge?" he asked. I could think of none and shook my head. "In that case," he said, his eyes sparkling, "we had better move on to the lounge. A banquet is in preparation to celebrate the return home of Firkin and myself." Again I felt ashamed of the emotion that rose at this reminder of the imminent parting, and overcame it by mentally putting myself in their places. Wouldn't I be happy in their circumstance? I would, indeed. "Any tears I may shed will be for myself alone," I said, striving for the light touch. "For you I am happy." Orthon and Kalner met us at the door, and we entered the lounge together. I saw that the large table on one side of the room had been set for service. Some of the women who had before been playing games were now putting on the finishing touches. When Firkin and Ilmeth came in by the far door, Kalner joined her friend, and the two girls left the room together. In a few minutes they returned, having changed from their pilot suits to lovely flowing robes. A beautiful cloth of gold and yellow fiber covered the table, woven in colored designs with no definite pattern. Places had been laid the full length and on both sides. The table silver was somewhat different in design from ours, and rather improved, I thought. It seemed to be made of various metallic combinations, beautifully inlaid. There was one chair at the head of the table and I counted 14 on either side. As Galna and Ilma III joined us, we were asked to be seated. There were still only the 8 women present, which left the men 21 in number, including myself. Ramu sat on the master's right and Furkan on his left. Almuth was placed between Ramu and myself, and Galna opposite, between Furkan and Ulthan. After all were seated, the master rose and for several moments the room was filled with a reverent stillness. Then, speaking in soft, distinct tones, the great teacher spoke these words: "We thank the infinite for present substance. May each and every one within thy vast kingdom be equally provided. Let this food strengthen our bodies that they may serve the divine spirit which dwells within them in ways pleasing to thee, creator of all life." After he had delivered this beautiful prayer, all joined again in a moment of silence. Then, before resuming his seat, the master said, "We are gathered here tonight to celebrate with great rejoicing the successful fulfillment of the mission on earth performed by 2 of our brothers present. Furkan and Rama have done well. We share their happiness in the reward for their efforts which permits them to return to their home planets." Crystal clear goblets containing pale golden liquid were on the table before each guest. As the master finished speaking, he raised his glass, saying, "Let us drink in blessing to one another and to our fellow men everywhere." As I raised the goblet to my lips, I was aware of a most delicate fragrance and sipped the contents very slowly in order to lose none of the bouquet. It did not appear to be of an intoxicating nature, but perhaps like many wines could have had that effect if taken in excess. As we lifted our glasses in honor of Ramu and Furkan, soft music that came from some invisible source filled the room. It was like no music I had ever before heard, seeming to vibrate through all my being, a melody strange and beautiful, with only occasional strains that were similar to earthly music. Since this was the first time I had been privileged to dine with those of other worlds, I was naturally curious to learn to what extent their food might resemble ours. At each end of the table, and in the center, were beautiful bowls filled with fruit. One variety looked exactly like large rosy apples, each with stem intact. I anticipated the crisp juiciness as I accepted one offered to me. Yet when I bit into it, I found the flesh of this fruit had the consistency of a firm, ripe peach, and the flavor was rather like a cross between a cherry and an apple. The core contained one large seed that looked like an immense apple seed. Another fruit resembled gigantic raspberries, both in appearance and flavor. The smallest of these berries was at least 4 times the size of our largest. Placed at intervals along the table were large pitcher-like containers holding a variety of fruit juices and other drinks. This explained the several goblets of different sizes in front of each place. The second drink I tried tasted like pure raspberry juice. Food was served to us by the 2 women who had seated themselves on either side at the end of the long table. First, they brought steaming dishes of vegetables from the service table, which stood against the wall close by. One contained what looked like ordinary carrots, but I found the consistency not so firm, and the flavor a kind of sweet sour. A second vegetable looked like the familiar potato. These, though peeled, were served in their natural shape. They had a slight yellow tinge and, although none of the coarse fiber of a parsnip, tasted more like that vegetable. Another vegetable which I tried had the leaves and coloring of parsley and a mild lemon flavor. There were many other vegetables which I did not try. A light eater by nature, tonight my emotions were so divided that I found myself with almost no appetite at all. I tried in vain to banish from my thoughts the purpose of this celebration. Furkan and Ramu, my good friends, would be leaving for their far distant homes. I did, however, accept a small piece of very coarse and quite dark bread, and a strip of what at first I took to be meat. The bread had a crust of golden color and tasted as though made chiefly of nuts, although I thought I detected a grain flavor as well. As I chewed the brownish strip of meat and mentally compared its flavor to that of well-cooked beef, Kalna called to me from across the table. "That is the dried root of the Venusian plant," she explained. "On Venus we cook the fresh plant, and then it tastes even better, but on our trips we carry it in dried form. It is especially nourishing as it contains all proteins found in meat and is easier for the human body to absorb. One strip of this root as served here is equivalent to 1 pound of your steak. It also makes excellent seasoning for other foods. To finish the meal, a huge cake was served. Although this had the appearance of what we call angel food, as it was cut I saw that it did not have the somewhat spongy elastic consistency of that cake. Moreover, though chiefly white, there were yellow streaks throughout. The texture was very fine and literally seemed to melt in the mouth. It tasted faintly sweet, although when the yellow was separated from the white, the flavor altered in a way difficult to describe. On the whole, I found it delicious. As I observed the others around the table and listened to their merry conversation, I realized that no one was eating heavily of the abundance of food, as so often happens at banquets on Earth. Yet all seemed to be enjoying it. At the end of the repast, the women and a number of men arose from their seats and cleared away their dishes. In the miraculous way with which I had become familiar, large doors suddenly opened out into a kitchen from the wall behind the table, which had appeared entirely solid. Into this room everything was carried. In a moment the guests returned to their chairs and the doors closed behind them. Now the background of music ceased as one of the men rose from his seat. Without accompaniment of any kind, he sang a song in his native tongue. While I could not understand the words, I listened enthralled to the beauty of his voice. When he had finished, Almuth said, "That was a song of farewell and blessing on the brothers who are returning home." The music rose again from its invisible source, louder than before and with a livelier lilt. This was explained when two of the women rose and, going to a cleared space beyond the table, began moving to the music in beautiful unison. Later, I was told that the dance represented the power of the universe. As I watched, I realized that one would need double joints and the suppleness of an infant to reproduce it. It was truly wonderful to behold, for every motion and posture of their bodies portrayed one after the other, the many moods of nature, from calm waters at rest through the most terrific storms of space. To describe such rhythm is impossible, but it was both fascinating and deeply stirring to behold. The young dancers themselves were exquisitely lovely, and their costumes seemed to change colors while in motion, yet I saw no lights playing upon them. The word grace, its superlative meaning, could not do justice to this beautiful performance. When the dance was over and a little time had passed, the master spoke to Orthon, who came over to where I was sitting. "Now," he said, "we want to show you scenes from our planet Venus. Scenes that will be beamed directly from the spot to this ship." I was delighted at the prospect of such a travelogue and wondered on which screen it would appear. But there was no screen. Before my astonished gaze, as the lights dimmed, the first scene hung suspended upon the space of this room. Orthon seemed to enjoy my amazement and explained, "We have a certain type of projector that can send out and stop beams at any distance desired. The stopping point serves as an invisible screen where the pictures are concentrated with color and dimensional qualities intact." The scene at which I was looking seemed, in fact, so definitely there that it was with the greatest difficulty I could believe myself still on this ship. I saw magnificent mountains, some white topped with snow, some quite barren and rocky, not very different from those of Earth. Some were thickly timbered and I saw water running in streams and cascades down the mountainsides. Orthon leaned close to me to whisper, "We have many lakes and seven oceans, all of which are connected by waterways, both natural and artificial." They showed me several Venusian cities, some large and some small. All gave me the feeling of having been transported to some wonderful fairyland. The structures were beautiful, with no monotonous lines. Many had domes radiating in prismatic colors that gave the impression of a revitalizing force. "In the dark of the night," Orthon said softly, "the colors cease and the domes become luminous with a soft, yellowish light. All cities followed a circular or oval pattern, and none appeared in any way congested. Between these concentrated communities there was much still uninhabited territory. The people I saw on the streets of these cities seemed to be going about their business in much the same manner as Earth folk, except for the absence of rush and worry so noticeable with us. Clothing, too, was similar, each person apparently choosing garments to his own particular liking while following a general style. I would estimate the tallest person I saw to be about 6'6", the average adult about 5'6", and the smallest not over 3'6". However, this latter could have been a child. I could not be sure, since none show age as we do. I know that I definitely did see some children, much smaller than this particular form.